Select your program.
Happenings.
Program initiated.
Approach the threshold. Engage rationality. Open your mind. Godspeed.
Blasting down to your listening devices, this is Flagship Freedom, the podcast that places you on the front line in the war of ideas. This is Michael.
And this is Danny, boy or girl, I don't know. Gender is oppressive, so today I'm just Danny person.
Very good, Danny. That was
I've been working on it. I've been training, sensitivity training.
Well, if you guys didn't really pick up on this sort of thing, we are we're going to be talking about a rather controversial topic today for our current event happenings episode. Now, I think that Danny and I haven't really talked too much about what our mutual thoughts are on the matter, so there might be some matters of difference, which will be fantastic for you, our listeners, because there's more than one opinion under the sun when it comes to this sort of thing. But we are going to be talking about the social justice warriors, and also college PC culture, and what that entails. And perhaps the way that we're going to be looking at it is very different from what you've been watching on YouTube when it comes to perhaps, you know, a lot of the alt-right material that comes out, who are seemingly the antithesis of the social justice warriors and sometimes just as bad. And you have a lot of other people that are coming out somewhere in between that are really opposed to this social justice movement. And I think that we'll talk about the alt-right in time, but right now it's our chance to talk about PC culture, the spawn therein, the social justice warriors.
What is a social justice warrior? Let's start this one off right. We have to define this, but it's such an amorphous, ambiguous term. I'm having a hard time actually understanding what it is. So what's your understanding of the SJW movement?
Yeah, and you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because social justice warriors, I'm not sure if there's a lot of people that come out and say that I am a social justice warrior anymore. It might have been something that was very popular, maybe sometime after I graduated from college, because I wasn't hearing that sort of thing when I was in university still. I knew that the PC culture did exist, that, you know, universities are a more leftist than rightist sort of institution. And so you get a lot of that sort of stuff in your general soft sciences, your social sciences. But I never really met someone, at least in university, that called themselves a social justice warrior. And that was really baffling to me when all of a sudden this came out. People kept on talking about SJW.
Well, is that more of a pejorative term that people give them? I haven't heard many people refer to themselves as an SJW.
Well, I do know this. Social justice is certainly a value of the modern day progressive. And that was definitely around when I was in university. It does seem like many of the individuals of which some scholarly articles that I've read about microaggressions and the social justice movement seem to point out that social justice it's a good thing. It's something that we should be striving for. And these are values such as egalitarianism. And this is the celebration of multiculturalism. And democracy plays a big part in the social justice warrior and making sure that things are fair for all, and the respect of every idea, no matter what it might be. And these are ideas that I think can be good, save for, I suppose, democracy. I do have a bit of a problem with, but the other things can be good. They can be good. The social justice warrior, and I think the culture, takes it to a religious extreme. And that is perhaps my theory behind the whole movement, that it is, in fact, a religion without the spiritual element, if you can understand. I'll be bouncing some of these ideas off of you, because I really want to work out this theory that I have in my head, that it is a religion without the spirituality, or it is a religious movement without that sort of mysticism behind it.
Yeah, it's definitely got the dogma. So I would categorize third wave feminism, as it's called, which is sort of modern day feminism, as well as the Black Lives Matter. To me, those seem to be connected to the SJW lefty crowd. Those are the types of people and movements I think of when I think of SJW. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would say so. To a large degree, yeah. I'm not sure if they would call themselves a member of those movements, but I think that an outsider looking in might have difficulty differentiating the two. I also know a lot of, you know, non-denominational Christians, you know, I would say even a lesser extent, some of those big, those mega churches that somehow have had the strong white guilt mentality built into them, almost like what you would witness from the Catholic Church, the idea of the culpa innata, the innate sin, that whiteness is a sin.
Well, yes, and now it's extended to being a male, straight, and also Christian, English speaker. Yeah, every one of the sort of dominant, I guess you could say, it is now, at least in the United States, right? If you're part of the majority, you are a racist, transphobe, bigot, by definition. It's the new prejudice.
Yeah, it does seem like they are interested in tearing down a majoritarian, right-wing, homogeneously white and typically male, the stereotypical patriarchy that the third wave feminists might be talking about. But I do think that there may be, I want to steel man this as much as I can. I want to give as much credence to this idea at first before I begin to tear down what I think are serious inadequacies.
You're right, absolutely. We need to give it credit where credit is due. So let's start out with the good.
Right, right. So I think that there is, and I'm going to list off a couple of these things, and you see what you think on the matter right here. But I think that the SJWs have identified a serious misappropriation of a force from the police. Now, whether that's a racial, whether there's a, you know, racial bigotry going on within the police force, I know I've read so many conflicting reports on you know, racism in Boston, racism like racism in New York. I've seen a recent study where there was, you know, cops in selected neighborhoods were more willing to apply force but less willing to shoot black individuals. And typically we're talking about African Americans or blacks in America. And this is usually what the SJWs are talking about. They're usually not talking so much about, let's say, Asians, or they're not usually talking about Latinos, or sometimes they are. But there is some part of the SJW or Black Lives Matter movement that is saying police are using a militaristic and over-the-top force structure or force tactic, and this is disproportionate to the kinds of crimes that are going on. For instance, drug usage crimes, which I think have been perpetrated by black people, have resulted in sometimes unfairly shootings. A lot of the videos that I've seen, a lot of the testimonials that I've heard, it seems that what happens is the media pushes out a narrative and then it has to reel it back in because the truth comes out. So it's very hard to discern all the lies from the truth in this matter, especially even when there's video evidence. But I think that it is brought, the SJW movement has brought out the conversation of police brutality, in particular against drug crimes. Drug crimes only harm those who are taking the drugs.
Yeah, with the SJW movement, it's like you said, I think it started out, as many movements do, with good intentions, or you could say, you know, to every argument, there's generally a kernel of truth somewhere in there. But I feel intuitively that, you know, and this is just as a result of sort of standing on the sidelines and spectating event after event after event and arguments and discussions, just sort of forming this it's like trying to, I'm sure you've seen that movie where they try to throw a sheet in the room and it lands over the ghost, and that's the only way they can discern its shape, because it's very hard. It's a movement that lacks definition, so you have to just feel it out as it interacts in society. But in any case, yeah, I think it's something that started out with good intentions and some truth in there for sure and legitimacy, but I feel like it's really gone off the rails and become, like you said, this religious obsession that... I don't know. Like, I really value self-critical analysis. And
yeah,
as you say, you know, white guilt, I think a healthy dose of the famous word checking your privilege, you know, basically understanding that society is not a perfectly level playing field. There are advantages and disadvantages. And this is sort of the root of compassion and charity. And those are all really great things. Like, I wish people would soften their heart and listen to their heart and understand that they need to be compassionate towards their fellow man. But you can go, you know, to a pathological level. And I feel like that's what the modern leftist movement, but in particular the SJW crowd, has sort of done. And, you know, maybe we can illuminate some more specific examples, but that's just kind of my general inclination. You know, I hate to judge people based on a movement that I don't understand fully, but that's really the overwhelming theme that I'm sort of getting.
It appears that they have problems with the injustices or the discrimination in the workplace for females, for blacks, to a lesser extent for Hispanics, but I don't really hear about them all that much within SJW crowds. With transgenders, they used to be strong proponents of gay marriage, but now that that is illegal, or excuse me, legal federally, not so much. Although every so often they'll bring up some injustices that might occur, but maybe I'm being a little cynical about this, but it seems like the SJW or the progressives used the gay rights movement as a political football. Because as an observation, I've seen them jumping from one movement to one movement to one movement, because the importance of creating a state of emergency or a state of injustice and making sure that it is heightened to hysterical levels is one of their tactics. The Saul Alinsky sort of guerrilla warfare, swarm them with lies. Facts don't matter so much as long as you can create a hysteria or emotional state within people to create social change. The facts don't matter as much. I mean, this is 101 rules of radicals. You know, if you haven't read it, you should read it because you'll understand precisely what these people are doing. You know, I see there are definitely instances of transgender people being persecuted because they are trying to make a transition. And quite frankly, whatever they want to do, they should be able to do. I have different issues with parents, you know, encouraging or trying to get their kids to make going through surgery in order to change their genitals, in order to change their gender, before they're actually able to comprehend that choice. But we see that there has been persecution with gays. There has been persecution with transgender. So there is a certain amount of validity. There's a kernel of truth to what they say. With the kernel of truth sprouts a great tree of iniquities. All right, so I know I told you about this theory that I have, this theory that the SJW movement is akin to a religious movement without the mysticism. There are certain dogmatic elements, certain irrationalities that often are intended to be explained away through faith for the movement of the quote-unquote priesthood of the movement, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what I think the priesthood is. One of the big things that I see that goes on within the SJW movement, I talked about the idea that you have to swarm them with lies, that you are attacking them on emotional sort of half-fact arguments, and then from there are 5 or 6 or 10 more lies that are created. They tell friends and family and social circles of the heinous grievances committed by fellow man in order to beat them into submission and apologize and apologize and apologize. And finally, they've been beaten into utter obedience. And this has happened, I've seen in universities. I've seen reports of professors discussing, I shouldn't say innocuous things, but academically based conversations of law surrounding rape, and people have had to excuse themselves because they have not been able to handle the situation. Or I've read where they've actually called out the professor for being insensitive because they've used the word rape and have been forced to apologize in front of the class because there are people that have been affected by that sort of thing. You wonder whether these individuals can actually live in the real world if this is the reaction that they are taking with every single potentially traumatic experience.
Did you hear about the professor? It was around Halloween last year who sent out an email, and he said there was this hysteria about not wearing insensitive costumes. you know, like Native American Indians, et cetera. And he replied back, guys, it's Halloween. I think we all need to, you know, take off, get off the high horse where nobody here is like wearing the blackface costume. You know, let's just relax and chill. I think this is a little ridiculous. And the backlash, he got like shouted down in the school courtyard by a crowd of students who would snap and instead of clapping. And this one girl famously ridiculed him for not creating a safe space, and college is not supposed to be an intellectual space. And that, to me, that's when I see things like that, it's like, okay, we should all be sensitive, but why the hysteria? Like, these are problems that like don't occur to most people. And that's when you have to ask, like, why? I feel like there's an undercurrent, there's an alternative motive. And I'm interested to hear the rest of your theory about the religious background, because there's got to be more. You know, when you see people making inconsistent or just ridiculous arguments, having contradictory points, you realize a lot of times what's the driving force behind that is some sort of internal hatred or desire for revenge or their own bigotry or prejudice. And, you know, I'm trying to whittle away to discover what that is. But I want to hear more about your theory here.
Right. Well, I think there's definitely a difference between where this came from and also what it is, because and perhaps to understand what it is, you might have to understand where it came from. And I would like to talk a little bit about what I think on that too, and what I've learned at least so far. But I think that it is very horrifying to know that all that needs to get done is to throw out incredible claims and watch a rational man spend hours of his life to fight against it, only for the social justice warrior or the movement to have moved on to the next social ill. It takes so long to build a solid case against one lie, as can be exemplified when in the 1930s or 40s, there was a campaign against marijuana. It's the drug of reprobates, they said. It's such a malevolent drug, it should be banned. And there is a stigma around it that still hasn't been expunged from this day. That's how long it took for that to happen. Can you imagine all these other things like the gender pay gap? This is a myth that, and I did say a myth, ladies and gentlemen, I said a myth, and perhaps we'll talk about this on a later date. There are logical and economic and also exemplary reasons why this is patently not something that exists in this world. And this is a myth that is proposed by third wave feminists and social justice warriors. There's an emergency created, and there needs to be a solution to it. And what is the solution? More government. More government is the solution. More legislation is the solution. And blaming the hapless straight white man. So
yeah, you just have to throw out something that appeals to people's prejudices, that people's internal undercurrents of resentment and hatred. And all of a sudden, you know, people respond to that. It's like throwing a seed into fertile soil. It just blooms up. And like you said, sometimes you hear an argument that's so stupid and off the wall that it actually is really, really difficult to address. It's like, I have to bring out the shovel, you know, where do I even begin? And you find yourself having to, you know, lay the entire foundation all over again.
Yeah. All right. Here's another observation. The SJW movement, I believe progressives in general, much like Christianity needs the devil or has the devil as an active force committing evil in the world, as it is in the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church, perhaps not in some other Protestant denominations, but the progressives, the SJWs, need their boogeyman. They need their Nazi. Since the 1940s, they have not had their Nazi. So they need to have a Nazi, and they've got one in Trump. I mean, that's an easy one. That is a bullseye right in the back of that man's head. But they also need other Nazis that are among the people that have infiltrated society. What is the boogeyman? Well, racism. Racism is a very big part of the world, and it manifests itself in a variety of things, from workplace discrimination to microaggressions, to the friendships and relationships that we build, you know, to low-income housing and gentrification, all this sort of stuff. And so there is a need for an enemy. And if there isn't an enemy, they must create one. So what do you think about that?
Well, it sounds like you're describing like a big conspiracy. But I don't think, you know, judging from the conversations I've had, I don't think your average, SJW is capable of that level of thought. It sounds awful, but I don't think they have that type of foresight. I personally think, as with it, a lot of social movements, you have generally good and decent people who've been sort of brainwashed, more or less, to accept a foundation, more or less, of lies, and you appeal to their good intentions. I mean, would you agree? I don't think each one of these people is out there trying to undermine society. I mean, there's that whole concept, sort of conspiracy theory of cultural Marxism. You know, I don't know how true that is, whether that's an actual orchestrated thing or not, but...
I think that cultural Marxism is at the heart of progressivism. I think that there is an idea that ideas, it comes down to the subjectivist level, that all things are equal in the realm of ideas, that there is no objective truth, and therefore we are the measure of all things. Each man is the measure of their own world and their own values within. So that is an extension of, you know, cultures and ideas cannot be better than one another. There is no hierarchy. There is no better. There is no worse. They're all the same. But clearly this is contradicted very, very easily by saying, well, do you find that Nazism is a very good way to live your life? Or do you find that, you know, communism is a particularly good course of action? Or, you know, how about Leninism or Mao?
They love communism.
Well,
they love communism.
They wouldn't say it outright. Socialism is one thing, but they would say it would be a mistake to conflate socialism with communism, even though we know differently. But, you know, you just present it. Is rape culture good? Absolutely not. Rape culture is terrible, but they would be the first ones to admit that it exists. So therefore, no ideas, ideas are not all equal. There are good and bad.
Self-detonating.
It is.
Right off the bat.
It is.
It's completely. So that's when you have to ask the question, like, when people have ideas that are blatantly and clearly pure nonsense, there's got to be something else going on. Nobody is, I mean, unless they're absolutely nuts, which I know they're not. So you have to keep digging, like, why? Why do you, who did this to you? Who got into your head? And what is your true motive? And my personal opinion, as I said before, is that it's actually motivated by hatred. It's just arose by any other name. It's the resentment to, you know, maybe the childhood where they grew up in, their rebellion against, you know, their straight white parents. And they feel, like you said, it's this white guilt. But I think there's something manifesting and they're just hiding behind these you know, legitimate complaints,
but,
like racism,
but hatred, I think, needs leadership. I think hatred needs a direction. You know, you can hate all you want in your parents' basement like an emo kid in middle school, but this is not going to manifest itself into a social justice warrior or an, you know, an alt-right nationalist. You need more of a leadership. You need connection to a community. And what I'm trying to structure or theorize is a greater framework from which this comes from. And I maybe I'm tipping my hand right here, but I do believe that the priesthood of this movement is the academia. And this is where, this is the heart of the beast right here. I mean, what was it that, I believe it was Marx said, something along the lines of, you know, you can have your corporations and your businesses, just give me the schools. That's all he needed. And that's all he knew he needed. So this is what I think is going on. I think this is where the problem stems from, because what better way to indoctrinate people than almost forced education, because you need to get a college degree at this point to be considered civilized and not a caveman. So you have to have that documentation, and that's 4 years right there. I mean, you got so much schooling that's in the public realm, and they have to be able to perpetuate this. And it's sort of like a snowball effect. More people that go into it become, it turns out, more academics. It turns out more leaders who are social justice warriors, perhaps not by name, but by ideology. It breeds that mentality. So, and they keep on coming back to that system, because many of them are participating in careers or education systems that are not going to actually get them work. So they're going to come back to the university.
So I'm trying to reconcile, like, I made it through college. I in my sociology class, which I four-pointed, but I was fed a steady diet of horse crap, and I was given extra credit to attend a lecture called Capitalism Hits the Fan, so it was by a Marxist.
Yeah.
Another one was What It Means to Be a Transgender Woman.
Yeah.
At the time, I was sort of defenseless in the realm of facts, but I felt I really rebelled against the general narrative, and I feel like that was – it's hard to explain, but, like, why does somebody like me, like, it just doesn't stick, you know? Like, by the time I get my bearings and I hear both sides of the argument, I'm like, oh, my God, that was complete and utter nonsense. But I feel like you could have never duped me into that movement, if you know what I'm saying. So that's why I have to – I feel like there's something more deeply seated in people who fall prey to this, is that it's a manifestation of their prior prejudices or whatever's going on in their brain.
Well, yeah, I think that there does need to be some sort of sympathy towards the injustices that are going on already. What happens from there is very key. It's the idea whether somebody has grabbed hold of you, or whether it's a book, whether it's parents, whether it's friends that have swayed you one way or another and told you to look at this from a rational perspective and examine all the facts before you make a conclusion. Perhaps there are individuals that are less likely to go into it because they already have a religion. This might be one of the biggest things that I might propose, that if you are an individual that has a religion already, you have objective ideas, your ideas that there is an objective world, that there is truth in the world, that there is an order in the world. There, you already have your priesthood, you already had a God above, and you have priests, religious leaders that tell you things that are contrary to what an SJW might be sympathetic to hearing if it wasn't for the fact that they aren't really religious people. If they don't have maybe a strong religious background, maybe they might fall prey to this sort of thing. I'm not.
So they're an empty vessel, in other words.
Perhaps. I'm not saying that religion needs to be there for somebody to not fall prey to this, but I'm suspecting, just due to the amount of social justice warriors that I have met post-university, and those who I would consider that sort of thing, they tend not to be very strongly religious, or also they tend to be very strongly subjectivist. One or the other leads them to an idea that all ideas are the same. A man is an island in an ocean of other islands, and we have to collectively bind together and create a government that can replace the religious system for which we have lost. So,
okay, so why? This is the question in my head. Why? What is the what's the end goal? And of, the puppet master or whoever is controlling and orchestrating this movement?
I don't think that there's a puppet master. I think that this is a natural progression of what occurs when society moves away from a religion. It goes towards, it naturally goes to another authoritative power structure, because the church used to be a very authoritative power structure. The Catholic Church was very centralized, and slowly over time it lost that power with the schism in the early millennia, and then you've got the Protestant Reformation, and then you've got all these revivalisms that fracture Christianity even more. I'm talking about Christianity, and I'm observing this here in America. This phenomenon may exist in other European countries. I'm sure that, I mean, subjectivism exists everywhere. But as I've observed it here in America, that's what seemed to start to happen here in America, and people moved and shifted their allegiances to a different power structure that can give them order and structure and can take care of them and can create a community around them. And they all go ahead.
It sounds to me like you're describing a baby who moves from one pacifier to another, and you just jam a new sort of irrational yet easy and palatable set of prejudices and beliefs that validate their base instincts and their base prejudices, which is, nobody likes to challenge their worldview or face the possibility that they're wrong. So that's kind of the theme I'm getting.
Yeah, I think that you're right. I mean, the kind of vitriol that I hear against religion is precisely the kind of aggression that I hear or that I read in writings against heretics, enemies of the church, against ne'er-do-goods and those of different faiths. From one to another. It doesn't matter from Christian to Islam, from Islam to Christianity. I mean, Judaism is not does not really proselytize all that much. So I don't really hear a whole lot of hate speech coming from them. You know, I use hate speech in quotations, but historically, this is the sort of equivalency that I see. The SJWs use that same sort of terminology to demonize and ostracize and to destroy their opponent and then build them up again the way that they want.
So it's like the pitchfork crowd, the modern day pitchfork crowd.
What is that?
You know, where you would accuse somebody of being a witch and then the whole town would grab their lanterns and their pitchforks and go burn them at the stake. And just the hysteria, you know, you can point to a common enemy and you give people that easy, you know, like you said, people need a purpose, a cause, and this is something that they can just set their targets on it and sink their teeth in.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, yeah, like a mob mentality, a witch hunt. That's precisely what it is. I think that they need their witches. And it is a witch hunt because they look for hidden racism and bigotry and majoritarian groups, and they intend on destroying them. How much value does, let's say, in academia, let's take academia, does a white professor defending affirmative action have on a college campus? A white professor defending affirmative action on a, you know, regular campus. Would you say that this professor might have, you know, might be favorable in the eyes of the administration or the academia?
Well, of course, from the standpoint that he's defending affirmative action.
Right.
Certainly. Right.
So what about a white professor attacking affirmative action on campus?
He's the devil.
Right. So let's isolate the variables right there. You know, let's say both of them are using rational arguments right there. Immediately on the basis of, you know, you're isolating everything else. They're both white professors. One's attacking and one's defending a very valued institution within the last 40 or 50 years. In a debate hall, one of them is going to get egged at the end. And it's probably not the one defending affirmative action. And insofar as both of them are speaking very fairly and honestly and also politely to one another, I think that much is quite clear what would happen. I don't want to stereotype this, but this is what I think would happen.
So what's your point?
So my point is the whiteness is not the issue here. It's whether you're towing the company line, whether you are following the particular dogmas that the SJW, the Church of SJW, has set forth. But as a white professor, you can be on the inside. You can be in the in crowd, just so long as you're preaching preaching the gospel, preaching the word.
See, I think race actually plays a huge role in it. Like if you are black and gay and transgender, all of these sort of victim cards, you have basically got it made. You can do whatever you want and say whatever you want because that's like the one hilarious way I've noticed to paralyze the SJWs is when they accuse you, which I have, of course, been labeled as a white male. That's always the trump card, right? Well, you're wrong because you're white male and you couldn't possibly have rational arguments because white male,
right.
White male.
It's a subjectivist argument.
You just tell them, well, I identify as a black trans female, non-binary ghost, Apache attack helicopter, and that you shut them down.
That's insensitive, Danny.
That is...
And they'll
that's what it...
Well, I'm sure they'll say you're being disingenuous and
how dare you assume my gender? My gender changes constantly. And I know I'm you know, making a caricature here.
Yeah, I know.
But that seems to be hugely important to them is the messenger and their race. Yeah. And it's gotten to the point where it's just the new racism.
Yeah, but Danny, I might point out people like let's say Thomas Sowell, who's often called an Uncle Tom. This is a black man who's been fighting against affirmative action and was not in support of President Obama, or Larry Elder, who's a conservative talk show radio host that's often called these sorts of names. They're black men speaking out against this, and race doesn't matter because they are against the party line. They only want to find these minority groups simply to use them as tools, no more, no less. So if you are no longer a useful tool to them, if you are a broken hammer or a wrench, you are cast aside just as soon as any other person of any other race. But if you are a favorable member of that particular race and you toe the company line, you are free to pass go and collect not $200, but $300. Because after all, this is what we're doing it for, right? You understand what I mean?
Okay, so you're saying that that minority members, whether it's your race, your gender, whatever, they are useful pawns. And as soon as they defy the narrative, sort of like Milo Yiannopoulos. He's a gay guy, and he's one of the most hated people on the right now. He's causing just this unbelievable hysteria, and it's so satisfying to watch. But yeah, like same with Thomas Sowell and other black conservatives. They're called Uncle Tom, which, Jesus, like the level of bald-faced racism. Like, you're calling somebody out because they don't fit into your neat little box, and they don't believe what you think black people are supposed to believe. Like, that to me is the ultimate in racism. And that's why I believe that, that's overt, but then you've also got the bigotry of lowered expectations, the soft bigotry where you believe that blacks particularly are incapable, and that's, you need the white liberals to come rescue you. I'm going off on a tangent. Right
no, now. No. I'm familiar with that. The soft bigotry of low expectations. That's been passed around a lot on the internet, and I do like it for good reason. I think that definitely exists. It exists, and progressives may not want to admit that is precisely what they are doing. They are lowering the bar for a peoples that they claim are just as capable, but are not capable only on the basis that the majority is squelching them. And, you know, if we just somehow, you know, gave this minority group money, then somehow they would be able to get back on their feet. But
while we're on the topic of black people, as funny as that sounds, I want to bounce an idea off of you.
Yeah.
Something on this subject that really stuck with me was, I don't remember her name, but it was this lady a little less than a year ago. She claimed to, it was a white lady, but she had somehow duped everyone around her. She's part of the NAACP, I think, into believing she was a black woman. You familiar with
that? Yeah, I've heard the story.
Yeah, she dressed up. She did her hair like a fro. She had a permanent tan appearance.
Yeah,
it looked really terrible. Anyways, when it all came out, she had to, you know, say something to save face. Whether it was true or not, she said, "I identify as a black person." And I'm thinking, hold on a second. It's one thing if you identify, you feel like your gender is wrong, and I understand there, you know, whether it's homosexuality or being bisexual or transgender, people are genuinely confused and they feel like they should be the opposite gender. But with race, I thought the narrative was that, and not just the narrative, but the truth was that the racial differences are overwhelmingly outward in nature, and they don't really come into play when it determines your personality and your character, etc. So for you to say, "I identify as a black person," what does that even mean? Because I thought all races were equal, and it's simply an outwardly thing. So when I hear that, I think, oh, so when you say you identify as a black person, you are basically marrying the race with black culture, you know, whether it's like the rap or the thug culture, whatever it is you want to call it. You are essentially implying that black people are innately tied to this, which to me is the actual prejudice, the actual racist idea. Because how else could you say I identify as a certain race? That shouldn't mean anything. Like, to me, like, being white is not part of my personality. It's just something that I have zero control over. And I care not what anybody's race or gender is. To me, I like to be colorblind. Well, I don't care whatsoever.
Are you?
I think she is the SJW on steroids. She's discovered that she loves this victim card, this victim mentality. She was caught setting up fake hate crimes. So she really got a high off of jumping on the bandwagon, which seems to be the mentality with the SJW crowd. They love either playing the victim or setting up victims where they don't exist.
But wasn't she attacked for this on the left? Wasn't the left rejecting her? I thought so.
I don't recall that. I could be wrong, but I would love to hear their response to that. But to me, the idea that you can just say that you are another race or another gender and just, you know, to me that is belittling and trivializing, you know, like for instance, you just like say, oh, I'm a woman and boom, now all of a sudden you're a woman. And I'm sorry, it just doesn't work like that. The one thing
that I've never understood, and I would love to hear from our listeners if I'm this is something that I've tossed around my head quite a bit. One certainly should be able to, by choice, transition to being a man or a woman. I don't want to have to pay for it, but you can do whatever you want to do with your body, okay? As long as you're not forcing me to do anything, as long as you're not harming me or my property, you can do whatever you want. But what I don't understand, logically, and also from, I think, an outsider looking in, is that if you want to make that transition, the statement is always, I've always felt like I'm a woman, or I've always felt like I'm a man, or a man trapped in a woman's body, or a woman trapped in a man's body. I wonder, how do you know the thoughts and the feelings of a man if you've never been a woman in the first place? How do you know what a woman or a man is supposed to feel like if you've never felt one or the other? Because you are a man, and you want to become a woman, and you are saying you feel like a woman, and you are trapped in a man's body. How do you know that you're not a man that's in a man's body, but you have effeminate thoughts? How do you know what effeminate thoughts are? And if you think you do know what effeminate thoughts are you stereotyping what effeminate thoughts are? Are you thinking about what these things might be on the basis of how you observe women outside in the workplace or on television or what it might be? So isn't that precisely what we're trying to not do? You know, stereotype people. You're acting the part of a woman, so therefore you are a woman, or you're acting the part of a man, so therefore you are a man. I've never understood that. It requires to me an outside, out of body experience for you to have a God's eye view of what you must have been or what you should have been. Like there is a deterministic world, and that you should have been this thing, and you are not this thing, so therefore you must make that change. To me, that isn't a very good justification for doing what you should do or what you're doing. You should just do it. Say, I want to be a man. Don't say, I feel like I've always been this. How do you know that? I don't understand.
Well, and there's a lot to sort through there, but one thing that does do is shatter the leftist idea that gender is a social construct. That is, gender roles. Like if men and women are supposedly exactly the same in all important ways, then it's impossible to feel like a man or feel like a woman, because that statement implies that there's a fundamental difference. But like my personal belief is that there are fundamental differences between men and women, not just outwardly, but in the way your brain is wired. I mean, to me, that doesn't require any stretch of the imagination. Your biological roles are extremely different. So I personally have no problem accepting the idea that, say, a guy, he just feels overwhelmingly feminine. And when I say feminine, I mean a reflection of what he sees other women in society doing, whether that's being more interpersonal, more family-oriented, less concerned with career ambitions and stereotypically manly things like combat and cars and working out and all that stuff. I have no problem seeing that men and women are interested in different things. So I see what you're saying in terms of it shattering the leftist paradigm that men and women are supposed to be perfectly equal and indistinguishable, but I don't think that's true. I think it clearly reveals the fact that there are innate differences between men and women, and that's fine, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Right, right. And I tend to agree with you. I do believe that there are differences between men and women, both physically and psychologically, emotionally, etc. What really it matters to me is how they're treated under the law in this society and in a free society. And in a free society, this really wouldn't be an issue because you don't have institutions that perpetrate mass racism. And when there is racism in a free society, and I think this might be a great topic for a later lecture because this is a big one, racism in a free society, why racism would not work out so well for a lot of companies and a lot of societies, and why racism will exist everywhere, but it would be penalized and therefore it would be squelched. But that's a topic for a different time. I think there's one more thing that I wanted to ask you about or run by you. And I think that you kind of get this. If every man is their own island, then facts really don't matter all that much. You cannot argue with an SJW on matters of policy because where they get their preaching, where they get their quote-unquote facts are through their feelings and through half-lies, half-truths, shallow research that is given to them by the priest class, their academics, their professors, the deans of the colleges, all this sort of stuff. They hear it from them and they don't do the research themselves. And, you know, it's tough because you get beat down in a college campus. You get beat down until you agree with what they have to say. Never mind the fact that Jews have been the brunt of easily the most horrific acts in recorded history, are the most successful religio-ethnic group in America. They're doing incredibly well, but they've been subjected to so much horror. You can't tell an SJW this. You know, they don't buy it. They believe that there's something intrinsically different because perhaps a Jew doesn't look a particular skin color. Or never mind, you know, that, you know, according to, it might have been a Heritage Institute or... No,
Foundation.
No. You know what? It might have actually been from the census. In fact, I'll look it up and I'll put it on the show notes. But I'm quite certain that I remember seeing that the top three earning groups in America are from East Asia, and they're clearly not white. They don't look white, but they are the most successful ethnic groups in America. They look different.
Right.
So if the majority is so racist that they would allow the intolerable racism that has happened in the past with blacks to continue through Jim Crow law, the abolition of Jim Crow, into new institutional racism and microaggressions, then why would they allow other racial subgroups to suddenly do much, much better than them? Wouldn't that defeat the purpose of being, you know, top dog?
Yeah. Well, this is why they don't talk about it. There's a lot of things they're conspicuously silent about, including Islam as well, the absolute antithesis of their worldview. But in terms of race, yeah, East Asians do better in general, and it doesn't comply at all with their worldview that basically the only reason white people are relatively better off than blacks in this country is because of racism, and they've essentially riding the tide of slavery and exploitation and all of that. It's an inconvenient truth, and that's why they don't talk about it. Asians had, you know, the Chinese had a terrible time here in America, and guess what? They got over it. And you don't hear this constant victimhood and this complaining and this race baiting. That's what I personally think the root of the problem is, this perpetual victimhood class. You're telling people that nothing is their fault. There's no personal accountability. There's no responsibility. It's this co-opting and the welfare state and this constant coddling that I personally believe is at the root of the struggles of American blacks. So I think you caught on to something that is a thorn in their side, and that's why they don't talk about it. And similarly with Islam, you know, the narrative is that white straight people are bad, and anything that doesn't match that, we don't talk about it. Even though Islam, I'm not saying all Muslims, but Islam is right now, its adherents, generally speaking, as a trend, are committing the most heinous and most intolerant crimes against humanity over in the Middle East in predominantly Muslim countries. And it's also, of course, you know, heavily misogynistic belief system. So all of these things shatter the narrative that it's all whitey's fault. And, you know, I apologize for going on a little rant there, but that's why I keep going back to this, my concept that it's all just a manifestation of prejudice and hatred. And it reveals itself slowly. You only know what a tea tastes like when you put it in hot water and you subject it to different circumstances.
Hmm. So then I guess we get to the crux of the matter, why it does matter. Why are we talking about social justice warriors and why? Because there's a lot of problems that are going on. The alt-right is another problem that we'll address further along down the road. I think Danny and I have had conversations about this perhaps more than the social justice movement. But why does this matter? Why does this matter? And I think there's a couple of things that I've identified. I think because these will be our next academics, our professionals, our social welfare leeches. I think that they genuinely ruin people's lives, that they have the tendency to do this. If this religion, so to speak, is allowed to perpetuate its dogmatic beliefs. I read a story a couple months ago about a boy meeting a girl. Boy has a drink with the girl. The girl says, you know, I don't usually do this, but, you know, I'll have sex with you. She has sex with him that night. The girl's really excited about it. And then she sees the guy making out with someone else. And then she goes to the police and she claims that he raped her. And then the guy got kicked out of the university. It was like Washington. Oh, I have it on my notes here. Washington and Lee University. He got kicked out of the university. Turns out that it was complete and utter fabrication. She was just jealous of him. So the social justice warriors and the movement does provide a blanket for the for those sorts of claims, the rape claims, and that this is a very deep and integral topic to this particular movement. You know, rights of women, rape culture, this sort of thing. Rape is a horrible thing, certainly so. Facts must rule over the emotional state of someone. So, you know, when individuals like Hillary Clinton say, you know, a woman must be believed when she says that somebody raped her, well, look, the claim of a rape can ruin someone immediately, from which they have to repair the rest of their lives in order to get back their integrity from their friends and family and all that. So this is why I think this is dangerous. This isn't to go one way or another, to go in one extreme and another, never believe women. It's just don't believe the people that are accusing one way or another until we have more proof in the matter. And I think that they're creating a culture of victimhood that is perpetuating the destruction of innocent people's lives.
Yeah, that's one of the manifestations of this culture. It creates sympathy and fertile ground for exploitation, of course.
And how about free speech?
Oh, right. Yeah, that seems to be also an inconvenient right that is slowly becoming eroded right now in generally private institutions like university, etc. But yeah, that's a kind of an interesting offshoot that you can no longer speak your mind. Everything's becoming hate speech. And I think this is just a Trojan horse for wanting to take the easy way out and silence your opponents.
Mm. There was a professor that was on Sam Harris, his podcast, Waking Up. Great podcast for conversations with a variety of people. He had a conversation with Professor Jonathan Haidt. He was from, I believe, NYU. I think it was NYU or Columbia. Anyways, professor talking about how he's a psychology professor. And he was talking about a psychology experiment where the word disgusting was used. He was playing a video for the students. The word disgusting was used to describe homosexual porn. There was a person that was in the interview in the video, and the person was asked, "What do you think about homosexual porn?" The guy said, "I think it's disgusting, but you know, it's not for me. I'm fine with gay rights. I don't personally like watching it." And not only was he condemned by a student who got up in fury and anger, by the time the class was over, there was an email in his inbox that stated that he was to be investigated for some type of discrimination. She demanded an apology, wrote a letter to the dean, all this sort of stuff, called Haidt a homophobe. And in turn, he wrote an incredible analysis of microaggressions, which we'll link to as well in the show notes, that I definitely recommend you guys reading. And, you know, University of Chicago wrote a strong letter against safe spaces recently. Do you remember that letter?
I haven't seen it, but yeah, there is thankfully a big backlash against this hysteria right now, and it's being exposed. And Milo Yiannopoulos, as I mentioned, the guy's doing a really great job of shedding light onto this destructive culture. And to tie into your last point, you know, why is this important? Why do we even care? You know, both of us are live and let live type people. Like, I really don't want to have anything to do with your irrational beliefs or your obsessions or your, you know, whatever. Can we all just please leave each other alone? But the reason this is important is because we are creating, not we, some people are creating a culture that, and a belief system, a pervasive belief system that is not a reflection of reality. And it is instead built on prejudice and basically the reinforcement of a narrative. Hmm. And anytime you get away from the things that brought us so far to where we are, self-ownership, individual merit, egalitarianism of rights, equality of rights, those bedrocks of society, you know, we're slowly getting away from that. And those are the things, those basic natural human rights, you know, as we slowly and gradually attack and erode those things, that it will spell the destruction of our society. As we become racked with guilt and come to hate prosperity and wealth and have to have racial quotas and equality of outcome, nothing good can come from that.
And we hate our neighbors simply on the basis of their skin color.
Yeah, we're coming full circle on racism and sexism. Like, we really are. We have reached that point. Now, like I there was a professor recently, I don't know who, we can link to it in the show notes. He was recorded saying, all white people are racist, period. Like, you can't make these overarching, broadly sweeping claims. And the same thing goes, all men are sexist. And oh yeah, you're going to love this. Of course, now minorities are incapable of racism because now the definition of racism has changed to prejudice plus power. You've heard of that?
Yes, I have.
Right. So it's just warping of definitions and a straying away from reality. Like, all these things are so crazy and otherworldly to me that I struggle to comprehend and encapsulate it all. But it seems like we're headed for disaster if we continue to capitulate to these hysterics.
I think that if you start to examine the reasons why we care about this, the erosion of free speech, the destruction of intellectual discourse, you know, the undermining of science, and that is certainly happening, then there is a lot to be afraid of when it comes to this new, you know, if you side with Danny that this is a, you know, this is a group of hate, or this is a, if you tend to think that this is a very religious or dogmatic group, sort of a replacement of religion, whatever it might be, I think there's reason to fight against this movement. And you're fighting against this idea, this culture of irrationality. And look, ultimately, Danny's right. Danny's right. It doesn't matter if you want to be irrational, if you want to reject science, it's fine if you're not going to pull me down with it. It's fine. So ultimately, I think a rational, ruggedly individual form of governance is the only way that you strip these people who I might deem, you know, disagreeable of power to use the state to legislate their you know, crazy religion onto the bulk of the community. Power in the hands of each and every individual, not majoritarian megalomaniacs. This is why one of the many, many reasons that we fight for a free society, because we don't want to go down with the ship, and we also do care about everyone else. But if people want to sink themselves, if they want to swim out into the middle of the ocean, if they want to be an island all to themselves in their subjectivist world, that's fine. We just don't want to be brought down with them. Danny, we've spoken for a long time, and I think that we're going to probably have to call it quits.
Yeah, and I'll take a couple shots. But yeah, very interesting subject, you know, something that is hard to define, and but is, I think, has been kind of creeping up on everybody,
yeah,
slowly as a an alarming trend. So, you know, we'll continue to watch it, hopefully have more conversations on the topic.
Yes. And I'd like to say in closing that if we've been unkind or unfair to this movement, I know we've been harsh on it. We try to talk about how it may have come from a kernel of truth, a semblance of rationality, but at the very least, we think it's gotten out of hand. And at the very worst, we think it's very dangerous. But if we have gone astray in any way, and you wish to defend this position, you can email us, flagshipfreedompodcast@gmail.com. Check out our Facebook page. You know, you can come on the show. We'd love to talk to
you
about this.
That would be awesome. I would love to have a conversation with one of these folks.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. If you think you can defend this, I want you to come on the show and talk to us about where we are not seeing the light.
We're genuinely interested. Like, I'm not interested in debating someone. I want to find out the truth. Like, yeah. If I'm wrong, if I'm smoking crack. So let's figure it out.
Wait, weren't you smoking crack?
Yes, I've been smoking this entire episode.
Right, right. That, there's a mystery solved right there. And maybe next episode I will join him. But for now, I remain crackless. Thank you very much for listening to us, ladies and gentlemen. I think that's all for now.
Catch you next time.
Bye.
You
see,
way down inside of me, darling, I have only one desire, and that one desire is you. And I know nobody else ain't gonna do it.